Chapter 9, The Kingdom of a Million Elephants. Perhaps in the Pleistocene, the cardamoms were an upland refuge when the lowlands were too dry, Gary mused. It's hard to believe that before people got here, there was anywhere that bears couldn't live. The great sociobiologist E.O. Wilson once said that a successful scientist thinks like a poet, but works like a bookkeeper. In pursuit of the lyrical vision of a vanished refuge for bears during the Pleistocene drought, Gary was as meticulous as any bean counter. At every available moment, from every available angle, he thought and rethought his hypotheses. Or perhaps the gradations between the separate lineages were wiped out by people, he continued. Or possibly, have sun bears confined moon bears to the mountains? Maybe in the Pleistocene we should think of lowland tropical rainforest sun bears competing with the moon bears and restricting the moon bears to these refuges. We discussed these ideas endlessly. In the minivan taking us to Bangkok's airport, we passed fruit markets under tin roofs, herds of blue pickups, stores selling spirit houses and lawn furniture, junkyards, Kentucky Fried Chicken outlets, and forested hills where bears should be living, but they've all been kidnapped or killed. But in the same way that the monk saw multiple incarnations, the dog who was once a wife, an elephant who was once a king, Gary saw, outside our windows, the landscapes of multiple paths. Dry scrub, lowland rainforest, mountain refuge. Now we were going to widen the scope of that lost geography. "We're going to Laos today," I announced to our fellow passengers as we neared the airport. "We are if the plane ever takes off and ever descends in anything other than a vertical dive," Gary muttered under his breath. Investigating the best way to get to Laos, we had considered several forms of transportation. Slow boats, known as Wei Sa, we had read in our travel guide, are hammered together with ill-fitting pieces of wood, the jerry-rigged engine coaxed along by an onboard mechanic. Do not have any seats. Landing involves ramming the boat into the riverbank, a process that can be very wet and muddy. Speedboats were faster. Powered by Toyota engines, they jet along at 50 miles per hour. We discarded that option when we learned that crash helmets were handed out before journeys. Train, often the best way to travel in Europe, was also out. Very little was left of the tracks, installed early in the previous century, and none of them led to or from Thailand. We could enter Laos by plane, of course, but airfare was expensive, except for the national airline, Laos Aviation. Several Western embassies, including our own, had issued travel advisories against it. We had asked Gary Van Zylen what he thought. His answer? They crash. How often? One crashed last week. Is this a regular event? They crash a lot, he replied. He added, they're very cheap. Would you take it? It wouldn't worry me. So we had purchased our tickets on the national airline to Vientiane. In the previous week, we had read in the Bangkok Post, there had been two armed raids in Laos and a spate of bomb explosions in the capital. Although Laos authorities insisted they had no idea who might do such a thing, diplomats agreed it was almost certainly the work of Khmer and Hmong minority rebels. Their two-decades-long insurgency had intensified since March, when the first of seven bomb explosions had wounded 10 tourists in a crowded outdoor restaurant named Chak Jai Mak, or Thank You Very Much, in Vientiane. Besides those that had exploded, several other bombs had been defused, including at the capital's airport, at the main morning market, and outside the Vietnamese embassy. The day before we left, a gang of 60 anti-communist insurgents, dressed in the stolen uniforms of high-ranking officers, had briefly captured the state offices at the border checkpoint between the southernmost province of Laos and Thailand. The rebels had fled with more than 100 automatic weapons. We flew off in the dark. Soon after, they reached Laos, whose putrid exhalations had proved fatal to all the missionaries who had encountered them. Count de Carnay wrote those words in 1872 in a preface to the book written by his son, Louis, Travels on the Mekong, about his explorations of the Mekong as a trade route between 1866 and 68. The book was published posthumously. the Carne died at the age of 27 of ailments he contracted during his voyage. The author described Lao as a region of evil name, protected by the rock with which its river bristles, and still more by the miasma exhaled by the sun's heat. Lao has suffered bad press ever since. It's the worst place in the world, a family friend, a retired army colonel who'd ventured there in the 1960s, told me. There is nothing you could give me to go back there. Like most Americans, he pronounced the name of the country as Laos. It is actually pronounced Lao, as in ow, an error that has done nothing to lend glamour to this little, landlocked, mountainous country. Today, Lao is one of the 10 poorest countries in the world. Its currency is nearly worthless. Upon landing, in exchange for $100, we are issued a 3-inch stack of no fewer than 779,000 kip. My eyes tell me either I am the world's richest man or using the world's most inflated currency, Gary commented as he tried to figure out where to stash the wad. Per capita income here is about $250. One child in five dies before its first birthday. The cars often live longer than the people. The opium addiction rate is twice the literacy rate. Lao is not a country, Gary Van Zylen had told us. It's a village. Until 1990, when a foreign aid project routed calls through an Australian satellite, only a single phone line connected Lao with other countries except for Thailand. The average Lao mails only one letter a year. Only one in 150 have television, and only one in 500 have seen a movie in the past year. A more common diversion is watching battles between rhinoceros beetles, a sport like cockfighting, which is also popularly enjoyed. Lao is saddled with the distinction of one superlative. It is the most heavily bombed country on Earth. During the 9-year secret war against the communists during the Vietnam War, the United States dropped 6,300,000 tons of bombs on Indochina, about a third of which fell on Lao. It was the heaviest aerial bombardment in the history of warfare. During the 1960s and 1970s, the United States rained more bombs on Lao than were dropped on Nazi Germany during World War II, 3 times the tonnage dropped during the Korean War, the equivalent of a plane load of bombs every 8 minutes around the clock for 9 years. Unexploded ordnance still infests the countryside. Despite the concentrated efforts of international demining organizations, 15 of Lao's 18 provinces were still considered significantly contaminated, and some 200 accidents occur each year. Abandoned by its secret American supporters after the fall of Saigon in 1975, Lao's government fell into the hands of the communist rulers who created the Lao People's Democratic Republic. The only word that's true in that phrase is Lao, said Gary, who had patriotically given up his college deferment, willing, though not eager, to fight the communists if his draft number had been called. 50,000 undesirables, such as civil servants, intellectuals, and royalist sympathizers, were rounded up and held captive in filthy, malarial jungle re-education camps. There, after toiling all day on communal farms, they were forced to memorize the resumes of communist revolutionaries, the names of battles fought, the numbers of people killed. An excellent student might be freed in 5 years, but most were held prisoner for 10. If they didn't die first of dysentery, cholera, hepatitis, typhoid, dengue fever, malaria, or starvation. Many, upon their release, fled the country. 10% of Laos citizens became refugees, including 3/4 of its intellectuals. It was an exodus that, in the opinion of some historians, set Laos' development back a generation. But today, Laos' leaders are less draconian in their approach. We had read that they had outlawed dollars, the use of scrap metal, the use of the letter R, despised in many Asian countries and usually confused with an L. We are pleased to serve you runch, comes the meal announcement on many an Asian airline. R and L are separate symbols in both Lao and Thai, but both are somewhere in between the Western pronunciation. So the English letter R became a victim of communist oppression. But we soon learned that such laws are ignored, and the government looks the other way. Dollars are in wide use. Houses and fences usually incorporate scrap metal. We found bomb casing used as flower pots. And R's adorn menus, hotel signs, and billboards. Laos' economic reforms now allow farmers to sell their crops at free market prices. Teenagers flaunt American fashions. And discos flourish in the capital. Vientiane, we found, is a city accustomed to accommodation. It is a city of ruin and resurrection. In the 8th century, the Mon occupied and then abandoned this city, and next the Khmer's. The Lao king Setatirat moved his capital here from Long Prabang, the city of sandalwood it was called, overrun by the Burmese, Chinese, and Siamese until the French found it swallowed in jungle in 1867. Like neighboring Cambodia and Vietnam, it was a colony of France from the end of the 19th century till the middle of the 20th, Lao declaring her independence in 1945. Many of the old French mansions now seem to be crumbling into dust. Some of them appear to be held together only by vines, as if the spirits of the place have not only accepted, not only forgiven, but actually embraced the city's past. The streaming roots of the ficus trees, too, seem to have bonded with the sidewalks, what sidewalks there are. In the main tourist district, dotted with restaurants, bakeries, and internet cafes, the sidewalks are land-bind with yawning man-sized sewer holes, giving new meaning to the term tourist trap. Visitors, addled with the heat, not infrequently fall in, plunging into a soup of Mekong and sewer water that makes any wound go septic. Gary and I were careful of these holes as we wandered the city, waiting for word from Nhi. She had gone on ahead of us to Lao and was negotiating with the army officers who ran the Tulakom Zoo for permits to allow us to collect hair from the bears there. Meanwhile, we had been advised to view Vientiane's Victory Arch. Gary Van Zylen had called it the world's largest vertical runway. It was made of 6,000 tons of concrete, originally donated by the U.S. government for a landing strip. Instead, the Laotians turned it into a large square monument that looked like it had dropped out of the sky and lodged incongruously at the center of the roundabout at the end of Long Son Avenue. It was intended, we learned, to turn the city's broadest avenue into a tropical Champs-Élysées, billed as a cross between the Arc de Triomphe and the Taj Mahal. The arch is a splendorous concrete monument, and it is praised not only by the Lao people, but also by foreigners who have visited Vientiane, explains a 35-page commemorative booklet, Victory Arch, Construction, Significance, Prestige, written by its designer. The monument was an international critical success. He reported, "Some visitors say the arch is the most beautiful, and no any architectural style of monuments in this region can compare with." We were not among those enthusiasts. To us, Vientiane's charms were more humble. At our hotel, an old French mansion with a courtyard embraced by fragrant purple-blossomed vines, a nanny goat was tethered to the front gate. Many of the streets are unpaved, and the red mud records the bare footprints of Buddhist monks who wander at dawn with their begging bowls, allowing the people to earn blessings by feeding them. There's a peace, even a serenity, amid the recycling decay on these uncrowded streets. The trees along the Mekong have epiphytes, ferns, orchids, and sometimes even cacti perch harmlessly on the branches, and some, judging from flower pots beneath them, quilled with spent incense, have spirits. Fig roots hang like hair, chickens strut in the streets, and along the river, people live as they have for millennia in thatched roof stilt houses. Beside the river, a man shucks corn, squatting on flat feet and folded thighs, and a woman cooks in a tin pot over an open fire. Children play checkers with bottle caps, and women prepare ginger-scented sauces with mortar and pestle. People carry wares with a bamboo pole worn across the shoulder from which two baskets are dangling from either side. Today you can still view scenes like those sketched by Louis Delaporte, the artist who accompanied de Carnet's 1866 expedition. The moments do not seem to travel as they do in the West forward in time. Instead, they hang, heavy and eternal, like the humidity in the air, past, present, and future all at once. Everyone moves with languor in the dense, moist heat. The young girls selling dried squid and Teletubbies keychains on the streets, the weary, pale backpackers searching for cyber cafes, the women sweeping storefront sidewalks with grass brooms, each movement as soft as eyelashes brushing a cheek. The sidewalks are in ruins, but on the roofs of crumbling buildings, satellite dishes gape at the heavens like supplicants requesting a boon, and on the hotels and restaurants, tiny Christmas lights wink gaily at one another in the night, as if they have overheard some whispered confidence. Poor, empty, secretive, beautiful Lao, English author Lucretia Stewart wrote in her 1992 travelogue, Tiger Bomb. The country's poverty, emptiness, and beauty were readily apparent to us even on that first day, but we were yet to explore its secrets. I wonder what bears think when they look at the Mekong, Gary wondered. Now, bears do swim to the ABC Islands, across cold waters with swift current, he continued, referring to the coal-black grizzlies of Alaska's Admiralty, Baranof, and Chicagoff Islands, the closest living relatives of the polar bears. We know this from nuclear DNA data that indicate regular crossings by males. Do moon bears think maybe there's a female on the other side and swim across it? Or do they think, man, that's a lot of water? Below us, the Mekong stretched like the endless ancient Naga on whose coils the Hindu creator slept, dreaming the universe into being. We were in the air again, on another Lao aviation flight, this time headed to Luang Prabang. The city was built by Nagas, the legends say. Many centuries ago, two sorcerers, arriving at the junction of the Mekong and Nam Khan rivers, found a paradise here, ablaze with crimson flowers of countless flame trees. The magicians conjured from the water 17 serpents to construct the city at this lovely spot. It's believed the Nagas guard it still. Luang Prabang has long been a city of miracles. Many generations after the sorcerers summoned its serpents, a baby was born here, possessing at birth a set of 33 teeth. Sensing a bad omen, royal advisors convinced the king to exile his son. On a raft complete with advisors, wet nurses, and servants, the infant was set adrift on the Mekong. A Buddhist monk found the child and took him to the court of the Khmer kings. He was educated as a Khmer prince, married to a Khmer princess, and, provided with an army, fought his way up the Mekong Valley atop a war elephant to found a kingdom of his own in 1353. He named his kingdom Lan Song, the Kingdom of a Million Elephants, testifying to his royal prestige and military might. Present-day Laos is about the size of Oregon, but this ancient kingdom extended into northern Thailand and what is now Shishguang Bana province in China. The king made the city of his birth the capital of his great empire, and here established the line of kings that would rule Lao for 6 centuries. Buddhism flourished in Luang Prabang, and its beautiful wats, epic poems were composed, sacred texts copied, great murals produced. Even after the kingdom moved its capital to Vientiane, Luang Prabang remained the center of the nation's soul. Until the last king was exiled to a work camp by the communists, this was the sovereign's principal residence. It is the home of the most sacred icon of the country, the Prabang, a golden Buddha whose image is said to have been cast in gold, silver, copper, iron, and precious stones, overseen by the god Indra himself. Twice Siamese invaders have captured the palladium, and twice they have returned it to Lao, believing it bad luck for the conquerors. The city is named in honor of the image. Luang Prabang, the Great Prabang, is now enshrined, as was once the king, in the royal palace. It's a city of Buddhas. They reside reclining and standing, granting boons, dispelling fear, dispensing wisdom, in more than 30 watts somehow packed into this tiny city, nearly one on every block, each name itself a sort of incantation. Temple of the Golden City, Temple of the Blessed Chant, Monastery of the Diamond Spire. Gary and I were eager to explore these wonders, but they were not the focus of our trip. Our permits were not expected to come through for several days, Nia told us, so in the meantime, we had embarked for the ancient capital of the Kingdom of a Million Elephants on an errand. We were looking for a tiger and three bears. There are bound to be forests loaded with moonbeers down there, said Gary, looking over the green swath surrounding the river below. But the bears we were seeking were in captivity, along with the tiger. Gary Van Zylen had told us he'd heard that someone was keeping them somewhere in Long Prabang. He'd asked us if we had time to look in on them and report on their condition. If they were in distress, perhaps the zoo could rescue them. But where were they? Everyone will know where the tiger is, Gary had told us, and the bears are on the same street. Was there an address? There aren't any addresses in Lao, he told us. Just ask around. We both felt unwell when we landed. The short flight had been wearying. We'd traveled in what I had dubbed the menopause plane. When we boarded, it was like a sauna, and the air conditioning had appeared to consist entirely of refrigerated wet cloths the stewardess had handed out to the sweating passengers. Halfway through the flight, though, cold clouds of condensation had begun to pour from the overhead compartment, and we froze. This was a preview of the chills and fever to come. Both of us were coming down with stomach problems, perhaps from an unwise encounter with ice cubes in the capital. Nonetheless, we set out immediately to find the animals. We spoke with a driver for the Auberge Catalau. The hotel was beyond our means, but the van had been sent to pick up a tourist named Jennifer, who never materialized, so the driver agreed to take us into town. He didn't know about the animals, but suggested we ask at the hotel bar. "We are looking for a tiger and three bears," we announced to the bartenders. "Do you know where we might find them?" Blank stares. Our request was incomprehensible. Our sentences were clearly not among those normally uttered by their clientele. "Tiger? Bear?" we repeated. "Oh, yes," said the barkeep. "We have tiger. Tiger beer." "No, no," we explained. "We're looking for a real tiger, a live tiger, a live bear." "Ah, you want the zoo," offered a barmaid. "For that, you have to go outside Vientiane." "No, no, this tiger is not in the zoo." "Tiger in the forest?" offered a bellhop. "Maybe, but you'll never see them there." After much discussion, suddenly the barkeep realized what we were saying. "Oh, yes, that tiger." It was a cub, he said, the only survivor of three, and it was living at the agriculture department, about a half hour's drive outside of town. Was it still there? He didn't know, but he knew who would. A Madame Sinoui, who is French, works at the agriculture department. Did he have her address? No, but she lives near Wat Ki Li, whose Buddha image, it was said, broke out in a cold sweat in 1958, signaling the coming war. We should go there. Long Prabang is a tiny place, the old city concentrated on a tongue of land only 1 kilometer long and a quarter kilometer wide. It did not seem a difficult task to find a house near Wat Ki Li. Gary was confident. We had no fewer than 3 maps of the city to help us. Gary adores maps and always has piles of them. I, on the other hand, have a profound distrust of maps. When I was a child, a map pulled out of the glove compartment was a sure sign we were lost. Although Gary could unfailingly locate almost any destination on a map, that did not mean we would ever reach it. There were a few street signs, and those that existed bore names that didn't seem to resemble anything on our maps. And, unfortunately, Gary is the only person on Earth with a natural sense of direction almost as bad as my own. "I can't understand it," he said, frowning at the 3 different maps. "I thought the Mekong was over here, and now it's over there." We wandered, feverish and lost, through the colossal noontime heat. The city was once home to a god-king, endowed with a 4-faced head, on whom I blamed all our troubles. Legends say he loved to set enigmas for the people. Perhaps he had designed our maps. He used to cut people's heads off when they failed to solve his riddles, until one day a wise man met his challenge and cut his head off instead. But being a god, his four-faced head, once severed, was hot enough to cause the atmosphere to burn, the rivers to boil, and the land to ignite. For this reason, the people had to keep his head in a cave. It only comes out once a year nowadays, on which day people parade its image through the town, pouring water on it all the time, lest it burst into flame. I wondered if perhaps the four-faced head had gotten out of hand again. We passed little wooden houses alive with peeping chicks and old French villas. We passed children playing catch the shoe in the streets and older boys hitting shuttlecocks with badminton rackets. Occasionally a monk flowed past in orange robes beneath a black shade umbrella, one of the few possessions allowed other than the begging bowl. And incredibly, we passed an advertisement in English for an herbal sauna, run of all things by the Red Cross. "Jesus Christ," said Gary, "I don't care what culture you're from. Anyone who wants a sauna here is crazy." We passed wat after wat. Temple of the Flaming Forest, Monastery of the Radiant Heart, Temple of the Bamboo Forest. None of them were spelled like the wats on our maps. No one could direct us to Wat Kili. Nobody we met knew Madame Sin Wee. Sweat drenched our shirts and socks and underwear and poured into our eyes. Our intestines were knotting with cramps. Finally, we went into a shop selling handmade mulberry paper and found an English-speaking clerk inside. "Madame Sin Wee?" Oh, yes, he knew her. In fact, she lived next door. We knocked on the door of a white house with light blue trim and shutters inhabited by a 4-year-old child and her governess. "Madame is at the office," the governess told us. But we had the right house, and when we returned that evening, we met Madame Sin Wee. Sylvie Dideron, her dark hair pinned up, flour from bread-making on her hands, stood in the doorway and told us that, yes, the tiger, a 10-month-old female, was still living at the agricultural station, and that we would be welcome to visit her there the next day. But of bears, she knew nothing. We had wisely asked a bellhop at the Auberge Candelau to write out for us, in curving Lao script, the directions to the agricultural station. This we handed to a tuk-tuk driver, and within 10 minutes we were standing before the tiger cub. She was contentedly chewing a rib of beef inside a spacious metal-barred cage. She was in perfect condition, her golden eyes bright, her flame-colored fur lush, her paw pads smooth and tough. The 9-by-12-foot cage contained a live tree, which she used to climb and to sharpen her claws, as well as 3 different types of floor, dirt, concrete, and wood, which was surely why she had not succumbed to the cracking paw infections that plague many captive animals. While admiring her cage, we were astonished to learn she had only been in it 3 months. "Before, she was with us," said Sylvie. "With us," we pondered. Did that mean the tigress was loose? "In the office," Sylvie said in her charming French accent. "A tiger cub roamed loose around the office?" "Where did she sleep?" asked Gary. "She slept with the students," Sylvie replied. "The problem is, she is big and began to catch and kill chickens. This must have been bad PR for the ag station, which was supposed to teach people the art of modern poultry keeping, which surely did not include allowing a tiger to roam freely through the barnyard." "The neighbors were afraid for their children," Sylvie continued, "so the cage was built." The tiger cub had been one of 3 unweaned babies the police had confiscated from poachers, she explained. One of them had died before police even had a chance to bring them here. The other expired despite everyone's best efforts. But no one here really had any experience in raising wild animals after all. "What about bears?" Sylvie asked several of the project staff for us. "The governor of the province has 2 bears, the head of the section of livestock and fishery told us. He was given them." The governor, he told us, was a very important man. He discouraged us from visiting his bears. A 3rd bear had once lived at the Fuxi Hotel. A big one, very big, he said. But it got sick, and although his veterinarians tried to treat it, the bear died several years ago. Wild moon bears live in the north of Luang Prabang province, the staff assured us, and tigers. Last year, a farmer shot a very big tiger who was raiding his chickens. We say, oh no, the tiger is to protect, explained Sylvie. But the farmer never understood. Like many Laotians, he saw the tiger as a nuisance, a bear as a commodity. One younger staff member said in 1992 he saw for sale a moon bear who was the color of the wood of this door, a golden brown, from an animal dealer. But no, no one ever brought a bear to the agricultural station. Certainly not. Having solved the mystery of the tiger and the three bears, we yielded to our increasingly insistent intestines and took a tuk-tuk back to the guest house. Our hostess was on the phone in the lobby. The call was for us. It was Sylvie. Someone had just brought in a bear cub. Would we come back and tell her what to do with it? We'll be right there, I told her. But first we went upstairs to get the tweezers and vials. We returned to the ag station to find, behind one of the offices near the chicken hatchery, a tiny cage of chicken wire and wood, half again the size of its inhabitant, a fluffy, black, blue-eyed male moon bear cub, perhaps 3 months old. He was so overheated that as a female worker hosed him off, he lapped what must have been a quart of water from the shallow bowl in his cage with his ribbon tongue. Then, exhausted, he dropped his leathery nose into the empty bowl and fell asleep. We checked him gently for wounds. There was a small cut on his nose, possibly from an exposed nail in his cage. I removed a tick the size of a kernel of corn from his ear and then took 4 good samples of his fine woolly hair. Now what? We had to find a place to keep him. The tiny, frail cage wouldn't do at all. Was there a poultry enclosure we could use? Yes, but it had bamboo slats for flooring. He would be able to chew right through it. We had to do something soon. We phoned Nee from Sylvie's office and left a message. Outside, we heard a terrible wail. Gary assumed it was from one of the turkeys who roamed the compound, tail spread with studied pomposity, or a Toulouse goose, its stately waddling interrupted by some avian emergency. But no. The bear cub, having woken from his nap, was wailing piteously and chewing so frantically at the cage that he had cut his gums and tongue, leaving flecks of bright blood on the wire. We had to get him out of there. Then I remembered the tiger cage. It had a sliding door in the middle that would allow it to be partitioned into 2. We hated to confine the little tigress to a smaller space, but a decent holding pen had to be found for the cub immediately. We slid the barred door closed and erected a sheet of plywood between the 2 partitions so the 2 animals would not see one another. We transferred the bear inside and breathed a sigh of relief. The little bear would be safe, and soon Nee would phone back to tell Sylvie what to feed him. In the wild, he would have still been nursing. I suggested Espalac, the synthetic bitch's milk replacement, and Sylvie laughed. In Luang Prabang, you cannot even buy dog food, she said. Dogs are fed scraps. I had no idea how to approximate a recipe for bear milk. But the staff at the Tulakom Zoo would surely know, and we felt certain that the zoo would soon rescue the little bear. We left exhausted but delighted. We could not believe our luck. Not only had we been able to help a baby bear, but he was scientifically of inestimable value to us. Here we had found a Laotian bear whose capture location could not be more certain. He'd been rescued from poachers, police told Sylvie, in the Viang Cam district, about 90 kilometers northeast of here, near the border with Vietnam. More important, he'd provided us with our first hair sample from this side of the Mekong. The little cub's DNA could help us answer Gary's question of whether the river was indeed a genetic barrier to moon bears. Back at the guest house, we wanted to celebrate. Instead, we doubled over with cramps. Insects, you know, don't get this, Gary noted during a rare moment when neither of us was in the bathroom. He had already taken all the Pepto-Bismol and were now nearing the end of our supply of Imodium. Insects' excretory wastes are funneled into the digestive system and have no moisture at all, the professor explained. They have malpighian tubules that funnel waste into the gut directly, and the lower gut extracts every bit of water. I was delighted to know that no matter how we were suffering, insects were not. If we're lucky, I said to Gary, we will come back as bugs after we die. Our days in Long Prabang passed feverishly. Each morning we woke at 4 to the sonorous gong of the temple across the street. The temple of the lively drum sounded its gong, drums, and cymbals to keep demons in their lairs, protecting the monks at sensitive times like holy days, full moons, and the times when the men shave their heads. Though we did not venture far from plumbing those first few days, we revisited the little bear, happy to find him comfortable in his new surroundings. We perused the Dala market. Nearby, Hmong women, having walked down from the mountains in their black traditional dress, hawked splendid embroidery. The main market offers the usual supplies of jewelry, cloth, and souvenirs, as well as local essentials, plastic bags of yellow sulfur and quartz-like saltpeter mixed with charcoal for homemade gunpowder. Here, from a Chinese merchant with a cascade of long hair flowing like a waterfall from a conspicuous mole on his cheek, Gary also purchased new scientific supplies, a pair of enormous pliers. He proposed we use these, instead of my tiny eyebrow tweezers, to pluck the dangerous bears of the Tulakom Zoo. Already we'd been practicing for this. We knew it might be too dangerous to stick our hands in the bears' cages. We might have to obtain hair in another way. I chased Gary around the hotel room, whacking him repeatedly on the head with a pole to which I'd attached a wad of sticky flypaper. Then we would carefully examine it to see if we'd obtained a follicle. I bet the hotel management doesn't suspect what goes on behind closed doors of their rooms, he commented. We awaited word of our permits. Meanwhile, we ate at French restaurants and Swedish bakeries. We wandered through the Watts, admiring magnificent murals. We climbed the holy hill of Fusi and gazed through a gate to see a rock that locals say records a footprint of the Buddha. 3 Watts are located on the hill. At one of them, I prayed for rain. Outside another temple, we watched the sun set on the shimmering river below while listening to the chants of the monks. The moment they finished, a musical clock in the temple chimed the tune Furi Lees. It is from Japan, a novice explained. We visited the hotel, trying to find out more about the deceased moon bear. Possibly they had even acquired a new one. To keep the language simple, we used in our inquiries only the present tense. Do you have a bear? Yes, yes, bear, said the smiling maitre d', pointing to his right. Where? We asked in astonishment. Here, he said, right here. Gary and I looked at each other wide-eyed. Our luck, apparently, knew no bounds. Right here? In the restaurant? Yes, the maitre d' insisted. In restaurant. He continued to motion us toward a table. We didn't see any bear. In Cambodia, we'd seen that many restaurants have bears, but they're not usually kept in the dining area. A live bear? Yes, he assured us. Have Lao beer. And he pointed toward the bar, where a mirrored wall was lined with bottles of the national beverage, Beer Lao. One day, fortified by antibiotics brought from the States, we fought our way through the stupefying heat to visit the Royal Palace. Here, a communist-run museum preserves the trappings of the monarchy it extinguished. Ceremonial hilts and swords, royal seals and decorations, gifts of visiting diplomats, the king's elephant saddle or howdah. To our astonishment, we also saw paintings of the kings. Un Kam, 1872-89, Kam Suk, 1890-1904, Sisavong, 1905-59, and no more. They don't have the rest because they murdered him and his family, Gary noted angrily. No one really knows how the king and his family died. The communist government did not officially acknowledge they were dead at all until December 1989. In Long Prabang, as journalist Christopher Kremer observed in his investigation of the fate of Lao's royal family stalking the elephant kings, history is spoken in whispers. This much is known. An army truck removed the king, the queen, and the crown prince from the palace and deposited them at Luang Prabang Airport in spring 1977 to be sent to a prison work camp. Various sources claim that the crown prince died of dysentery and the king of malaria and starvation in May 1978, and the queen wasted away 3 years later. Others say the king died 6 months after the queen. The monarchs are said to be buried in unmarked graves at the base of a great tree along a river. We saw the famous Prabang in an unlit room inside a curtained shrine, behind an array of elephant tusks, plastic flowers, incense, and a crystal chandelier. The Buddha's arms are held out with flattened palms, like a policeman halting traffic. With this gesture, legends tell us, the Buddha once subdued a rampaging elephant. But far more moving and far more troubling were the walls of the palace throne hall. The murals here are spangled with colored mirrors set in a wall of crimson, created in the 1950s to commemorate the 2500th anniversary of the historic Buddha's passing into Nirvana. One wall depicts a battle scene. It could be from the Ramayana, the Hindu epic, or it could be from any of the ancient battles from Laotian history. Sword-bearing soldiers are busy lopping heads off. The heads fly from the necks cleanly, like a shuttlecock from a badminton racket or a golf ball from a tee. In one corner of the room is a case filled with ivory-handled swords, which may have been used for this task. Here, Gary dispensed another gem from the treasure trove of his biological knowledge. You know, it's neurologically possible that some consciousness persists for several moments after beheading, he said. Theoretically, at least, these people might have been able to see their own headless bodies as their heads flew through the air and rolled on the ground. Would you have time to actually understand the sight? What would one's thoughts be at such a moment, I wondered. Probably, Gary replied, there is sufficient time to think something like, ouch. In the palace of a murdered king, we stood in a room decorated by scenes of monstrous cruelty dedicated to a saint. But perhaps the Buddha would have been pleased. The central tenet of Buddhist teaching is not obedience nor salvation through grace. It is compassion. Compassion. The words mean with suffering. Anyone who is loved knows passion as a twin of pain. The Buddhists call it dukkha. In the folk language at the time of Buddha, it referred to a cartwheel that cannot turn properly because something is wrong at its very hub. Suffering, this state of profound disharmony, is at the heart of earthly existence, Buddha taught. Compassion does not quench suffering, but marries it. And so, perhaps, it was no accident that these scenes of suffering are painted in mirrors. In the images of ancient, ruthless cruelty, we see our own faces. Other scenes in the mirrored glass depict ordinary activities, people planting rice fields, plowing with water buffalo, riding on elephants. During the Vietnam War, the nation to which Gary and I owe our allegiance dropped 6 million tons of bombs on farmers like these. In 1965 and 66, our Air Force rained 200,000 gallons of poison on Laos forests and rice fields. We bombed elephants as transport vehicles. We might prefer to view the scenes on these walls in a mirror darkly, as the Apostle Paul wrote of the unenlightened of his day. The soldiers and the farmers, the victims and the kings, these people are not us. But as the Apostle exhorted, as the Buddha taught, in the spangled walls of the throne hall, as in the faces of doomed war prisoners, the eyes of captured animals, we cannot escape our own reflection. The rain, when it came, was a great cool balm, like a mother's soft hand on the forehead of a feverish child. It carried the heat away like the lustral water in which the Prabang is ritually bathed each April at the start of the Lao New Year. It extinguished the fire of that king's severed four-faced head. On this day, the Mekong shone rosy as a polished copper tea kettle, and we traveled upriver on a long-tailed boat to its confluence with the Nam U, out to the Buddha caves. In the mist, it's easy to imagine the Nagas the sorcerers conjured here. Their images guard many of the temples, their scaly bodies lolling down the banisters of the temple staircases. In their gaping mouths, the monks place small offerings, balls of sticky rice and bits of fruit. By morning, the offerings are always gone. The river trip afforded us a chance to view potential bear habitat. To either side of us, the forest looked regal and refined, like silver filigree, less monstrous than the Amazon or the Congo. The bamboos splay like water sprayed from a palace fountain. On the vines, huge leaves are strung like Chinese lanterns. Big rocks clutch the riverbanks like the toes of a giant. There are two hills ahead, coiled one against the other like sleeping lovers. Our young guide, who was once crowned Miss Long Prabang in a beauty contest, tells us this is in fact how these hills came to be. They are the stone reminders of Long Prabang's Romeo and Juliet. Forbidden lovers, they ran away to the forest, took poison, and died, clasped in each other's arms, forever joined. We traveled an hour before we reached the huge pale cliff face, the site of the Buddha caves. During the war, many Buddhas burned, says our pretty 23-year-old companion. The caves were the sanctuary to which the damaged icons were taken, a refuge for injured Buddhas. The Lao people, too, took refuge in caves during times of strife. During the rain of bombs and defoliants of the Vietnam War, caves offered the safest shelters. The communist Pathet Lao's shadow government operated in a network of caves, complete with a hotel cave, a hospital cave, even a theater cave. Because these Buddhas were damaged, no longer could they be venerated in a temple. So they were brought here, to a large upper cave and a smaller lower grotto. There are some 4,000 Buddhas in all, some stone, some bronze, some ceramic, some lacquered, some covered with gold leaf. Some are nearly a story tall, others only inches. Some have burn marks or missing limbs. From their position, standing or sitting, they all seem to look out of the cave, facing the Mekong, serene, smiling, eternal. In this limestone hole, literally eaten by time, they are timeless. They stay here, bestowing blessings, dispelling fear. Several of the images depict the Buddha seated in the lotus position, reaching forward and touching the earth with his right hand. This posture testifies to the Buddha's enlightenment, symbolizing his victory over the demons of desire, a mudra called calling for the earth to witness. On the second day of the new year, the Lao of Long Prabang come here to ritually bathe the Buddhas as they do the Prabang. But most of the time, the Buddhas wait in their dark cavern refuge, absorbed in the bliss of inner illumination. They contemplate eternity in the company of spirits far older. Long before that king brought Buddhism to Lao, our guide told us, this cave was already sacred. It was the abode of nature spirits, she said. Those spirits are still here. From the ceiling, I feel something fall softly on my head. I shine my flashlight above me. And here, on the ceiling of this natural Sistine Chapel, we can see the winged guardians of this holy place, little nature spirits who, in this particular incarnation, have taken the form of bats. Finally, our permits came through, and with them the day we'd been awaiting and dreading. When we arrived back in Vientiane, Ni told us more about the bears we would pluck. Because for much of their lives they had been starving, through the widely spaced bars of their cages, they frantically seize in their claws any object they might possibly consider food. Otherwise, another bear might get it, or the food might pass them by. In this way, one of the bears had so savaged the arm of a female zoo worker that it had to be amputated. My coffee cup trembled as I set it in its saucer that morning, but we couldn't pass up the opportunity. These were some of the most geographically crucial bears of the study, Gary reminded me. Almost all of their capture sites were known. One had been captured in Nam Tha, in northern Laos, near the borders with China, Thailand, and Burma. Another had come from Xiabuli, where Bertha and Dave had been captured on the same side of the Mekong. This bear, a female, was important not only to test the veracity of Dave and Bertha's haplotype, but also to see if they're genetically distinct from the Nam Tha bears caught across the river. And several came from various sites in the Annamite Mountains. Four were from Boli Kham Sai province, at the very top of this remote mountain chain. And these might quite possibly turn out to be a very distinct haplotype, if not a new subspecies, or even a new species. The zoo was nearly deserted when we got there. As we waited for Ni, Jill, and a new volunteer, Claire, we saw a pretty Laotian woman, with a wide, sweet face, walk by with a folder in one hand. She had only one hand. One arm was missing. The zoo was an attractive spot, situated on 25 acres and built in 1991 on land owned by the Lao Army. Ni, Claire, and Jill appeared and led us past a large, leafy enclosure for binturongs, a pool with turtles, and grassy outdoor cages for muntjacs. We passed a field where workers were busy mixing concrete and digging, an area slated soon, thanks to Gary Van Zylen's organization, to be a large outdoor bear enclosure like those at Bang Lamung. Ni introduced us to the army officer in charge of the zoo and to several of the zookeepers, none of whom spoke English. Next, we met the bears. First, in a cage detached from the others, was the huge, tame Elsa, a former pet of a German expat who'd obtained her in Nam Tha. I plucked her hair with no problem. Next, we met Miggy, another sweet adult female with an astounding face. Her snout, instead of being long and dog-like, was squat and bunched. A perfect pig bear, Gary said. We were told this was the result of a deformity that left her always panting. Miggy, one of the two survivors of the culture park, also yielded gracefully to my tweezers, even seeming to enjoy the attention. But the other bears were progressively more difficult. Two small females from Udom Sai province were very wary. I was able to retrieve only a few hairs from the back of one's leg while Gary fed them both bananas through the cage bars. A large female cub in another cage was too skittish to approach and was known to attack people. She was from Luang Prabang province, and we already had hairs from the little cub we just visited, so we didn't chance it. Besides, the most critical bears and the most dangerous were still ahead. These were the bears from Boli Kham Sai and Xiabuli provinces, among them the bear who had savaged the zoo worker's arm. Two of the bears had been sent from Lak Sao, the town where George Schaller and his team had discovered the Sao La and the giant muntjac. The bears lived in a series of cement-floored, adjoining steel cages we called the blockhouse. The cages were arranged in such a way that we could duck beneath a steel beam and stand surrounded on three sides by cage bars, through which six bears were threading their huge paws, trying to grab us. Their desperation was terrifying. No matter how well they were fed for the rest of their lives, they would never forget nearly starving. Would they forever feel anger, too, toward our kind? Our position gave us the feeling of being in a cage ourselves. Our movements were severely restricted. If you backed up more than a step or two in any of three directions, you were within someone's swatting range. And as each cage contained two bears, there was never a point at which, even directly in front of you, there was only one bear to worry about. Each attempt at gathering hairs carried a different risk. The tweezers required very close contact. The giant pliers allowed more distance between the hand and the bear, but the implement was so big and clumsy it could jam on the cage bars if you didn't withdraw it properly, leaving your hand stuck inside. We tried the pole and flypaper method. Our target, one of the subadult Xiabuli females, caught it in her paws. Now we were horrified the bear would try to eat the flypaper and choke. Eventually we fished it out. all the while, Western, Thai, and Lao companions were shouting advice in various languages, usually something like, "Watch out," in response to which you could not leap away or you would land in the outstretched paws of another bear. Meanwhile, we were baking. The sun ate into our skin like acid. The humidity pressed on us like flesh. Sweat poured off our faces and stung our eyes and made our fingers slippery. But somehow, eventually, we secured hairs from at least one bear from each of the localities, all except the important pair from Lac Zao, which I couldn't seem to nail. Seeing our dismay, two of the zookeepers threaded their bare hands through the bars and, with lightning-quick grasps, came up with a dozen hairs each. Gary stuffed them delightedly into vials. Drenched with sweat, dizzy with relief, I was the first to stagger out of the blockhouse. I smacked my head on the steel beam and saw stars. It was oddly appropriate. Long before Western astrologers named the constellations Ursa Major and Minor, people all over the world have looked at stars and seen bears. We flew back to Thailand with vials full of hair and hearts full of hope and sorrow. Scientifically, our expedition was so far a huge success. The desperate rescued bears at Tulakom, the orphaned cub at Long Prabang, all were great boons to us. We hoped what we learned from their DNA would one day help restore captive bears to their rightful homes. But I couldn't shake the sorrow of knowing that our data was only made possible by their tragedies. Beneath our plain stretched forest, rice paddy, river, temple. The forest seemed forgiving, deep, like a secret kept, a vow honored. The paddies below shimmered like the mirrors on the mosaic at Long Prabang's royal palace, green, copper, and gold, winking up at us with reflected light.